Hello, this is Aitana, and you're listening to Season 1 of the Swim in the Strait podcast, where we talk with swimmers of all sorts from the New Zealand swimming arena, from swimming every day through the winter to crossing the Cook Strait. We will hear stories of passion, perseverance, and dedication.
Welcome to Episode 7 of Season 1 of Swim in the Strait. Today's guest studies the ocean for a living. He has spent half of his life traveling the world to do so, and has dunk himself into almost frozen water in the coldest place on Earth. I have the pleasure to talk today to Craig Stevens.
Good morning, Craig. Thank you very much for interviewing with us, joining us today in the Swim in the Strait podcast. How are you?
Yeah, good, thanks. Kia ora, Aitana. Nice to be here.
Thank you very much. I am very excited to talk about swimming and water and a few other interesting things.
Cool.
Two oceanographers in a room. Yeah, this is going to be interesting.
Well, you know, I've listened to some of the earlier podcasts and, you know, some of the people you've had on the show are pretty amazing swimmers. So it's a little bit intimidating to be here, actually.
It is a little bit intimidating for me as well. So, yeah, no, it is good. I think it is very interesting to listen to the stories of the people around here. So I'm quite keen to hear your story.
Sure.
So my first question is always the same. Have you always been a swimmer?
Yeah, thinking about that, not really. So I grew up in the hill suburbs of Adelaide, and so quite a distance from the ocean. And some of the time actually was in London as a kid, so, you know, further from the ocean even. But in Australia, a long time ago when I was a kid, they had really big school holiday swim programs. And so that was a highlight of being a little kid, was for 2 or 3 weeks every summer. And so, you know, a South Australian summer, it's pretty, well, you'd know from Spain, but, you know, 40 degrees was pretty normal. But I have really strong memories of being in outdoor pools, and the one I went to, it was the girls' high school. And so as a young boy, this was quite exciting to be allowed into the forbidden sort of land of a girls' school. And I was quite good at that sort of swimming. It was sort of surf life-saving run. So there was a real focus on, you know, yes, competency, but also being able to rescue people and, you know, basic sort of towing and all that kind of stuff, which is all great in flat, warm water. And so you'd get like certificates and gold stars and stuff. But by the end, as I was getting to be a teenager and sort of less into being told what to do, the higher levels was almost seemed to me to get into sort of water ballet and, you know, performance of being able to do funny tricks underwater and stuff. And so I didn't really get into that. But after that, I did a lot of sailboarding and windsurfing. So, and when I moved to Perth, much more time in the ocean, in the warm Luan current that comes down from Indonesia, right? So, you know, you swim all year round. The middle of winter, you wouldn't believe how warm the ocean is, right?
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Don't tell me, please.
And so a lot of sailboarding, a lot of time at the beach and stuff in Western Australia. They're gorgeous beaches. And scuba and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, a lot of time, but not sort of distance swimming or anything like that. That really only sort of kicked in. I moved to Vancouver in British Columbia. And the coast there is very different. You know, you don't have massive beaches, it's fjords and cold water. But where I worked at a university campus, and, you know, the winters can be long there, and they had a couple of great indoor-outdoor pools. And so really that was the start, so mid-early 20s, of just really having it as part of my daily routine. And that certainly continued, you know, for the long time I've been in New Zealand since. And so, you know, that's what I was saying before, being intimidated by some of your other guests, the amount of time and their resilience for swimming in the ocean. That said, I spend a lot of time thinking about the ocean and being in the ocean in my sort of day job as an oceanographer, right? So I feel as if I have some some sort of knowledge to come to your podcast around how the ocean works. Especially cold water, because I'm, I guess, at least half of my time is spent on Antarctic oceanography at the moment. So I feel I have some legitimacy from that perspective, if not bravery, but certainly legitimacy.
Yes, of course you do. Well, I have a few questions already. When did you transition into open water swimming? Because even though you say that you haven't done, you know, like long distance, I've seen you in the open water. You've swum with me a few times. So when did you go from pool swim to open water and why?
Yeah, well, I think the initiative, it's probably 10 or 15 years now, the Harbour Swimming sort of network that started up in New Zealand sort of 10 or so years ago, just to, I think it's awesome that you might get sort of 500 people leaping into the harbour and doing, you know, not a trivial swim. And so sort of the training and getting into that kind of thing, that's probably what got me started. And then having people like you drag me along, make me feel guilty. you know, like if I struggle to, I have quite a busy work day. Well, I think I do. And so I often make plans at the last minute to get, and it's easier to get in the pool than the ocean for me. But, you know, on those nice days that you're at the pool and Dougal just gives you the side eye because you really should be in the ocean. So
we call it community support.
Yeah, right. Yeah, guilt from a distance. But also, you know, these last 2 years, I live just over the hill from a really nice beach, Worcester Bay Beach. It's not super popular, but it's protected from most of the wind directions. And so, I've been really getting into that as a routine for just a short little ocean swim. It's really nice.
It is nice to get in the ocean and to get into the cold water. So talking about cold water, what is the coldest water that you have been in?
Easy. I mean, I've probably been in some of the coldest water on the planet.
Please tell me more.
So one of the topics I work on for my Antarctic work is seawater that's kind of come up from the deeps, but sort of rubs against the edge of ice, and so it starts to melt the ice. But it does it down deep, and so that melting happens at quite, because of the pressure, happens at quite a low temperature. So it's below zero. A lot of the seawater, because of the salt and the pressure, there's a kind of seawater called supercooled. And so it's actually colder than the freezing temperature. So,
but it's not frozen.
No, but it's trying to. So there'll be ice crystals and stuff forming and sort of floating up to the surface or attaching to the seabed and stuff like that. So and that's the kind of thing that doesn't go into computer models or isn't seen by satellites. And so that's why we work on it. -2. I've measured seawater as cold as about -2.4, I think.
Wow.
I can confess, and so don't tell any of the sort of operational people, but I have jumped in the seawater. We'd cut a hole in the sea ice for a little autonomous mini submarine. And so we had this channel is about 3 meters long. And so I swam 3 meters quite quickly in I think it was almost -2.
How was that? Those were the fastest 3 meters of your life, right?
Yeah. Well, not the least because seals had been seen. You know, seals would come and sort of hang out.
Say hello.
And when you're up close to a seal, they're quite big. So it was quite a quick swim. Yes.
Did you have an ice cream headache?
No, a massive adrenaline rush. A massive adrenaline rush is what it was. Yeah.
How do you get warm after? Do you get enough time to get cold? I mean, it would be cold you get in, but
no. I mean, you get cold once you get out. Mm. And so it's just around quickly drying off and putting all the clothes back on. So
because some of the people around here, they are trying to qualify to swim an ice mile, it's called.
Okay.
And I was discussing with the ladies the other day, and then they were saying that you had to swim 3K in 10 degrees.
Right.
And I thought that was...
No, I guess I specifically have training not to be doing that kind of thing.
Oh, of course, yes, because you will be to go to Antarctica, I guess. And for our listeners, you will have to do some survival training.
Yeah. And sort of recognition of hypothermia and that kind of thing. So yeah, we're literally trained not to get into those situations. So I confine a lot of my cold water ocean stuff to data.
Good. That is good. Well, actually, talking about data, there is a paper, like a scientific paper, that has been written maybe in the 70s or in the 80s about swimmers crossing the Cook Strait.
Oh, yeah.
And I find that fascinating that the author of that paper used the swimmers to try to infer the current on the Cook Strait. Is that correct?
Yeah, yeah. A paper by Ron Heath, I think it's probably early 80s. And, you know, I don't know that people, because, you know, you can see computer models and simulations of almost anything these days. And I don't know that people understand how hard some of this stuff was to measure even only a few decades ago. And so in the 70s and early 80s, it was not really easy to measure currents in the ocean, especially. Just backtrack. I mean, it is possible, and we've been making measurements of currents for, you know, 60 or 70 years. But when you think about the currents in Cook Strait, you know, they're up to many meters a second. And so the traditional ways where you put a big weight on the seabed and then you have a wire that's held upright by some subsurface floats, and then you put instruments on that, you know. And as I'm telling you this, Aitana, you know, I'm looking across the table at an oceanographer who has done this professionally. So this is for the listeners. So in the 60s and 70s, you'd have these literally little rotor meters. So they'd actually, you know, they'd have a spinning windmill that they'd count and store on magnetic tape. It's pretty awesome. But in the really strong currents of Cook Strait, that just kind of gets flattened out on the tides, and so doesn't really work very well. And and you can't really run them near the surface. And you often want to know about what's happening at the surface, both from search and rescue. You know, you want to know where something will drift. But also that's often where the wind pushes, you know, larvae and sort of rafted seaweed and stuff like that. So there's lots of reasons you want to know what the surface is doing. And so there's this lovely paper where, you know, the support boat would be taking its position every, you know, hour, half hour or so. And so there are these tracks. You know, we're quite used to this sort of stuff now. You know, you can go online and monitor someone's real-time progression and cheer them on. But this had to be done by hand. But it's kind of nice looking back, you know, what are we, 40-plus years later, you can sort of still envisage their journey, you know, the amazing thing these people did. And
I was... We had a field rush the other day in the show, and we were talking about Cook Strait. Field rush is the person who you have to go to if you want to cross Cook Strait swimming. And I was asking him if there was lots of changes before and now. And he was saying that one of the things that is different now is the GPS, right? That they can get the position in the GPS, but they still use the charts. And they get the position in the chart to know where are they and the currents. And of course, they use the current and the wind just to help the swimmer to get to the other side. And one of the things that he was saying is that one of the reasons why Cook Strait is so hard to swim is because you have to time everything, the current, the wind, the swimmer, because if you miss the South Island, you're gone. You will not make it. So I think as oceanographers, for the listeners, if they don't know what an oceanographer is, we try to understand the ocean and the physics of the ocean kind of thing. And we do measurements, like observations, we call it, like the real world, instead of modeling. And we measure things like temperature, salinity, or current, in this case, in the Cook Strait.
Yeah, I think... picking that sweet spot between the weather and the tides. So one of the things I work on when I'm not working on Antarctic oceanography are eddies produced in sort of strong tidal flows. And you know, so it's no accident that I work in Cook Strait, right? So there's really strong tidal flows back and forth. I don't know if people are aware of this, but the wave, the tidal wave that's caused by the moon, the gravitational attraction of the moon, but also affected by the Earth's rotation, is this sort of peak and trough that rotates around New Zealand. It cycles around. So it's quite often, it's high tide on one side of the strait and low tide on the other. So literally, the water goes downhill through the strait, by sort of half a meter. It's a real thing. It's quite amazing. And that's what gives us the really strong flows. But there's also some sharp headlands, you know, some, especially on the south coast, or off the Marlborough Sounds. There are these sort of fingers that stick out into Cook Strait, and they're drowned river valleys. And so they're the sort of the remnants of that kind of structure. And so as the tide sort of scrapes past these fingers sticking out into the strait, it generates really quite strong eddies. And these are very difficult to measure. They've always been difficult to measure, and they're very sort of chaotic. You know, their formation point makes sense, and you know that'll happen, but how big they be and where they'll spin off to is quite hard to predict. And so I think any swim across the strait will, as well as picking that sweet spot between the weather and the tides, it's also beholden to the sort of the vagaries, the randomness of the sort of eddies and some of the other ocean processes that are quite hard to predict.
And I think this is one of the beautiful things about open water swimming, right? That it's not only that the swimmer has to be fit and just focusing on what they're doing. It's also that you have to time all the other things that you actually can't control.
Yeah.
You can only hope that they are going to work on your favor. But I am an avid follower of all the crossings across Cook Strait, so I put on my screen at work the little dot that is swimming. Mm. And sometimes I also, because I work with weather forecast, I have the current forecast. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to see if they're gonna make it across before the tide is changing. And you go like, come on, you can do it, you're pushing, go faster, you're almost there. Because if the current changes, like, you literally are going back into the strait. So you have to kind of swim fast in order to
Yeah, you've only got a certain window.
Exactly, yeah, have a certain window in order to make it.
But it's interesting looking at the marine charts from our hydrographic service. You know, they've got a warning there for Cook Strait. Is, you know, I think it says something like, occasionally the tide will not turn. And so what they're talking about there is that there'll be basically a separation point around one of the headlands. And so if you're in coast close to the coast, you'll kind of be in a back eddy. So the tide is still happening, but from the perspective of being in a current, you're going in the opposite direction to the tide. So what it's saying is that it's this point about things being unpredictable and eddies being really important, especially around spring tide. And so that's one benefit is I think most swims, you'd go for the neap tide if you're sensible, I think.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's also why from all this, like, I mean, of course, there are many swims, but Cook Strait is part of the Ocean Sevens. And I think Cook Strait is one of the hardest swims to do because you are dealing with so many factors and also the cold.
Yeah. We had a team just a month or 6 weeks ago, I guess, doing, we call it drifter work. So sort of an underwater sail, maybe a couple of meters down to a float at the surface with a GPS. And we're trying to do what Ron Heath did 40 years ago. And it's not uncommon for them to just go in the opposite direction to where we think, or sideways or stuff like that. So, you know, even with our understanding and with our GPS and all our computer models, there's a randomness associated with the complexity of flow in the strait. It's pretty neat.
It is indeed. Maybe we could design a little sensor that we can put at the swimmers just to get some more.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's that kind of technology is available for surfboard fins. There's a program out of California where you can sort of get an instrumented fin, you know, with people's little tow bags and stuff like that. No little motors allowed, though, I don't think. Just a little engine.
No, only your togs.
That's right. That's right.
Your togs and your goggles.
Yeah.
So what do you think is so special to swim? Like, I find New Zealand, Oriental Bay and Cook Strait, all of this around. Why do you think it's...
Takes your breath away, right? I mean, pardon the joke about coal, but, you know, if you stop and sort of look around, the beauty of the place, and it's sort of rugged. The ocean is big, you know, we're in... So I give a lot of talks around sort of why ocean science is important, and I have a favorite slide, and it's just a screen capture of Google Earth. But if you take the right sort of view, if you stick the eastern seaboard of Australia just in one corner, and you've got California just on the other edge, basically half the globe, with New Zealand and a few Pacific islands in it, is ocean. And so it's a massive... It's a massive thing. It's a massive part of how our planet works. And I don't necessarily think about that when I'm swimming. I just think about the cleanliness of the environment, which is a little bit artificial because it's not always true. And just the beauty of fluid mechanics, really.
Of course you do. Yes. But it's true. Yeah, like the ocean is like... everywhere, like 3/4 of...
Yeah, something like 70%.
Yeah. So yeah, definitely. So something that I also ask my guests on the other shows is, what do you think about when you're swimming?
Sometimes I just count.
Oh, okay. What?
Yeah. Especially the timed sort of harbour swims where there's a slight reason for not being really slow. I would just get into a rhythm of just counting up to 10 or something and then restarting just to give me something to focus about. Think too much about work, but that's kind of, I mean, that's a sort of a mental kind of decluttering kind of process. I think about what I can see. You know, if you're in the sort of shallows and you can see the seabed. So where I grew up was very famous for sort of sharks, great white sharks.
Great. I love this, you know, like...
the Aldinga drop-off. And so, you know, there was a very famous survival story from a shark attack from a bit before when I was a kid. And so... So yeah, that loomed always, but I'm less concerned about getting eaten by a great white shark these days, and more sort of interested in seeing what the sort of starfish and other cool things are doing, and the seabed ripples, you know, and the other thing is, you know, I think about, you know, I've spent a lot of my life thinking about stratification and how things it makes our planet operate how it does, and so I can't help but think, oh, that bit's cold, oh, that bit's warm, oh, I wonder why that bit's cold.
That is actually pretty interesting. This morning I went for a swim in the harbour, and we swam around the fountain, and we stopped a little bit. I was swimming with another lady, and she was like, oh my god, this is so warm, did you feel it? And I was like, yeah, this is warm. And I listened to a lot of comments when it's been raining that you can see, you can not see, but feel the surface,
mm-hmm,
like different. Why is that?
I mean,
raining, as in a lot of rain, as it rains in Wellington.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I guess maybe it's coming in at a warmer temperature. It'll stratify and trap. So the water at the bottom won't necessarily sort of come in touch with the stuff at the surface. Often I would have thought that would have made it colder. So it's interesting that people feel warmer. I can relay when I first started at Niwa in New Zealand, we were looking at measuring the effect of rain on waves. So, you know, the rain drops cause sort of little rings, ripples, that potentially can affect the little ripples caused by the wind. And so it might sort of affect how fast waves grow. And so we had a radar, like a police radar, that could detect sort of waves on the water surface. And so this early experiment, they had me out in a little rowboat with a fire hose from the shore, you know, because we'd come up with this plan in the office, right? And so we were going to fire these raindrops into our radar footprint and measure the impact they had. But of course, anyone who's ever held a hose knows that it pushes you in the opposite direction. So you've got this guy with a PhD just, you know, 30 meters off the coast, just being pushed around by, you know, it was like a cartoon. And so I like that part of science. I like sort of goofing off and trying things. But quite often we learn some quite basic lessons.
That's good. Any learning is good learning.
Yeah, we only did it once.
Yes, I agree. I have two more questions for you. In all the places that you've been, because you've been traveling quite a lot around the world with your studies and your PhD and work, can you name a favorite place to swim? Or worst.
Freiburg in Oriental Bay, it's pretty amazing. I do have to say, that's one's local beach is nice, but I got to jump off the back of a boat in the middle of Arrow Lakes in British Columbia. And so this is a glacially scoured lake that's sort of 80, 100 kilometers long, and we're at this branch point. So basically you're in a water-filled fjord, fjord lake. And it's hundreds of meters deep, and it was middle of summer, and we just jumped off the back, and it was, there was zero wind, snow-capped peaks. That was pretty sweet.
That is cool.
Yeah, a storm came through later on the day, and we
as you do.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
That reminds me, because I try to get in the water like everywhere I go, even if it's just for a little dip. And I did something similar in the North Atlantic, in the Middle Atlantic. I was going from Spain to Cape Verde, and the same, we just stopped the boat. It was a research voyage, and we jump off the back as well in the middle of nowhere, and that was pretty special as well.
Yeah,
it's scary.
Yeah, it's less easy to do these days, you know, in terms of health and safety and stuff like that. But back in the day, I had done some swimming off boats in the middle of the ocean in 4 or 5 kilometers of water. It's quite amazing.
Is quite amazing. The Big Blue is, it's just, I think that's one of the reasons why I did oceanography. And when you are in the middle of nowhere, it just gives you a little bit of perspective, put things in perspective and how little
I mean,
we are.
So I actually came to oceanography via engineering. I'm sort of a water engineer by training. And so some of my early work was in sort of weird systems like mine pits that have been closed and that are filled. And I've swum in a couple of those, and they're pretty freaky. They're often hundreds of meters deep, but just this hole in the earth filled with it. I have the advantage of having done some sort of chemical analyses to know what I'm swimming in. And so you pick and choose, right? But that's also quite, it's not a natural environment, but it's an amazing environment.
Mm. Yeah, one of the things that I like is just to get used to where you swim. And this is related to the second question that I was going to ask you. When I started swimming in Oriental Bay, I haven't done a lot of open water swimming before. I mean, yes, I've been just jumping in the water when I was a kid, but not really swimming. And Oriental Bay is kind of an enclosed bay, right? So when I started swimming, I had to get used to all the factors around, like the waves I was used to. But then suddenly I realized that I could hear stuff. And I was like, oh my God, what is that? And then I realized that the things that I was listening or hearing is like, for example, the fountain going off or the ferry going. And it, like at the beginning, I was like, oh my God, what's that? What's that? Until you realize that actually it's just because sound travels in the water. And then you can hear almost everything that is happening around.
Yeah.
And it's just fascinating once you get used to it and not panicking.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, swimming's good for that. Scuba is also kind of amazing too. Because you take boat traffic more seriously. You know, if you're down at 10 meters or something and you hear a boat go past, you sort of want to know about that. But you can actually hear some of the sort of clicking and stuff from marine life.
Yes.
But also with scuba, you can hear your own breathing and heartbeat and stuff much more clearly. And I think you kind of, you're in tune both with the natural environment because you're in it, but you're also sort of listening to your body work. And I think that's quite a neat thing, actually. Yeah, just that. And then you see a big fish and it.
Yes, or you swim to the first buoy on your own and you get a little bit of a panic and you go like. But yeah, I think this is something amazing that you can be in tune and in the moment, and also with the cold water, it just brings you this kind of, the time disappears and everything else disappears and just here now and kind of, you know, like.
Well, and swimming's the same, right? Is especially if the conditions are, you know, tough with waves or cold, is. Again, you're thinking about how your body's working in the environment and just thinking, right, I want to make sure I've got enough energy or warmth to do what I want to do and get back. And I think there's, you know, it's good to be in tune with that kind of thing.
It's very humbling.
Yeah.
So what is next? Are you going to get into winter swimming with us?
Oh, yeah, we see. Yeah, so, you know, it's been a funny couple of years, right? And so I just keep getting knocked out right at that transition point. Because, you know, everyone tells you, happily swim all year round with a wetsuit, but it's that transition to just getting, you know, colder and colder without a wetsuit. And so I've always had excuses to not do that. So I don't know if this year is going to be any different, but...
Well, you've been getting better in swimming in the winter, even if it's with wetsuit.
Oh, yeah.
So I think that is a step forward.
Yeah. And it's as you know, and anyone else who sort of does this kind of thing, it's just so exhilarating, right? Really resets the body for the day.
Yeah, definitely. You just think you're going to die for the first minute and then it's fine.
Yes, that's right. If you survive that first minute, yeah.
Cool. Well, thank you very much for that. That was fantastic. And is there anything else you would like to discuss?
Sure. I guess, you know, my day job gives me a kind of unique perspective on the planet and the ocean planet. And, you know, we talked a lot about cold water. But I guess it's, I do all these things to sort of relax and decompress and stuff, but at the back of my mind, you know, the oceans capture 90%+ of the heat that the planet is gaining through our sort of use of fossil fuels. And so it's kind of a little bit bittersweet to be in that environment knowing that it's changing and that we're causing it, and it's a big deal. So I won't turn the podcast into a downer, but it's in the back of my mind that environment is so important to us, but it's changing. It does make things a little bit warmer, though.
Yeah, that's true. I actually think that is also one of the reasons why we should spread the word and talk about swimming or any kind of thing that relates and that you know, like that make us know the environment and love the ocean. And because you cannot protect something that you don't know or you don't love.
Mm.
So I think it is not for us because we we've lived in that kind of environment. But for the newer generations, I think it's quite important to keep doing this swimming summer camps or this community. And we've talked about lots about the community in Oriental Bay or in Wellington of inclusive, just come and swim with us, because that is kind of, you know, showing what is that we have and hopefully inspiring people to go out there and do things. And that way we will help with the protection of it or the study of
That's right. Yeah, if you don't know something, you don't care about it. It's too abstract.
Yeah, exactly. Again, thank you very much for your time. That was fantastic.
Kia ora, no problem.
Yes, and we'll see you in the water.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Swim in the Strait podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe to our podcast, connect on social media at Swim in the Strait, and leave us a rating on your favorite podcast platform.